You know, we often spend time with entomologist Phil Pelletieri talking about any and every type of insect you can imagine. It's always a lot of fun. And today we're going to talk with the author of a wonderful new field guide, and we're going to zero in on beetles. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. My guest today is Arthur Evans. He's an entomologist, author, lecturer, photographer, and broadcaster, and he's written and co-written many books, including An Inordinate Fondness for Beetles, The Field Guide to Beetles of California, and the National Wildlife Federation Field Guide to Insects and Spiders of North America. His most recent book is what we're going to talk about today. It's titled Beetles of Eastern North America. And Art, welcome to the Ideas Network. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm telling you, this is an absolutely gorgeous book. Beetles are beautiful.
Well, I've known that for years, and so have many of my colleagues, but I think many people don't pay them much mind, and so I hope they'll get a chance to look at this book and see how beautiful they are. Their colors and patterns and behaviors rival that of butterflies and other insects that people tend to think as being a little bit showier.
Yeah, well, they're beautiful. How many species live in the world?
Well, it's estimated there are about 400,000 species of beetles around the world. There's roughly 25,000 species that live in the U.S. and Canada. And the Mississippi River divides the North America, or United States, I should say, roughly in two halves. And most of the diversity is in the west, but we probably have around 12, 13,000 species east of the Mississippi River.
No, that's amazing. What do we know about when they first emerged and how they evolved?
Well, what we know about beetles, we're still learning about beetles, but they're approximately about 200 million years old. There are fossil records dating that far back. We can see the damage they've done to plants way back when, preserved in the fossil record. And they and other plant-feeding insects really took off when angiosperms, flowering plants, sort of came on the scene about 65 million years ago.
Well, they really are fascinating. We're going to have a chance to cover a lot of information relating to them. And I want to give our listeners a chance to join in. As you listen in, are you a Beatles fan? What intrigues you? And maybe you've observed some beetle behavior that you found interesting or perplexing, and Art can explain or comment on it, certainly. And maybe you have some experiences to share. Give us a call with your questions or comments at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or you can post on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. And as a matter of fact, Chris from Wisconsin Dells wonders, found some beetles about an inch long and gray with flat backs having a beetle party on my sunflowers. They ate all the seeds on the sunflowers.
Off the top of my head, I'm not sure what that is. You know, like I say, there are lots of beetles out there. I work much better with pictures and specimens. I'm not sure I could identify that just from that description. It's possible they could be, if they have a distinct ant-like head, it could be possibly a blister beetle, but without seeing them, I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's a tough one without a more detailed, well, a photo's best.
Photos best. Well, actually, a specimen in hand is best.
yeah.
Photos can still be kind of tricky, but they're welcome to post things on your Facebook page, or they can post images on my Facebook page at Dr. Art Evans Entomologist.
Yeah, that would be one. If you got some photos of beetles you want to have identified, just go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and Art can take a look, or on his page as well. I have a link to your page on my page, so there
you
go. Well,
I've got a link to your page on my page, so it's all good.
Okay, there we go. Well, tell us this book, before we go any further, I've got to just ask you, this is a huge undertaking, and the photography is just absolutely unbelievable Tell us though how you put it together, how you organized it. And...
Well, it was a challenge. I wanted to put together a book that was engaging and informative and up to date in terms of its classification, but of course all that hinges on the photography. And thanks to the internet, especially a website called bugguide.net, I was able to connect with photographers from all around the world. In fact, four of my contributors to this book are Wisconsinites. Dan Young, Nadine Kriska, Carrie Katovich, and Jeff Gruber all contributed either photos or information to the book, for which I am very grateful. And
Dan Young's been an oftentime guest on this show.
I'm not surprised. I've known Dan for years. Anyway, I began putting a list together of species that you just feel have to be there. And then you start filling in the gaps here and there to make it as taxonomically as broad as possible. And then you start scrounging around for other species because there are good images. There are a few surprises in the book, but I think most of the 1,400-plus species are those that people are likely to find or something very closely related throughout the region.
Yeah. What's the life cycle of a beetle?
Well, it depends on what beetle you're talking about. generally speaking, I should say some species of beetles have an annual life cycle where there's one generation produced per year. Others will produce multiple generations per year. And even in some areas, it may take several years to produce one generation. Again, all depending on the species. But they're holometabolous insects. They have a complete metamorphosis, four distinct stages: egg, larva, pupa, and adult. And the larvae are sometimes referred to as grubs, and they live in the soil, feeding on plant materials, living or dead. Some of them feed on decaying animal materials or animal dung. Others are boring through wood or leaves. The diversity of habit and habitat is mind-boggling.
Yeah. How do they fit into the larger ecosystems in which they live?
Well, like all insects, they're part of what I like to call the FBI, fungus, bacteria, and insects. Those are the agents of decomposition. They're helping to break down plant and animal tissues and into their most basic elements, nutrients, and making those nutrients available to other organisms. Beetles in particular help keep plant communities in check through their plant feeding activities. Some beetles are predators, and therefore they keep animal populations, to a small extent anyway, in check. And of course, both the larvae and adults of beetles are an important food source for all kinds of insectivorous vertebrates. Think fish, reptiles, amphibians, birds, and many mammals too.
Yeah, and so they're important for biodiversity.
Well, as I said, they help regulate plant and animal communities through their activities, so that's very important. And they represent a sizable chunk of animal diversity when you consider, if you were to line up one example of every living species, every fourth one would be a beetle, and half of all beetles are weevils. If you were to add plants to the mix, every fifth species would be a beetle. So they are the very personification of biodiversity.
Wow. Rick in Menominee, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Yes, good morning, and very interesting topic. What I was wondering about is invasive species types of beetles and either benefits or destructive kinds of things that they would be doing in Wisconsin, what your comments would be about that.
Well, I have to say I'm not that familiar with specific things going on in Wisconsin, but I can talk to some of two important species, invasive species of beetles that from Asia, the Asian longhorn borer, which is or longhorn beetle, which is attacking a number of different broadleaf tree species in its larval stage. And then you've got the emerald ash borer, which is a very serious pest of ash trees throughout the region and potentially throughout the continent. And
they're both right here in Wisconsin and creating problems.
I'm sure they are. And this is sort of typical of any invasive species. It's outside of its normal distribution, and therefore it doesn't have the usual checks and balances, predators, pathogens, and parasitoids that keep their populations in check, so they have a free run of this new habitat.
And the second part of Rick's question, you know, are they beneficial? You sort of addressed that in some ways earlier in the things they provide.
Well, there are some species, some leaf beetles, for example, and weevils that are specialists on certain kinds of plants, a very specific species of plants and or their reproductive structures. And when that's the case, they can be used as biocontrols, and they are brought in as a natural control to control the proliferation of plants that we consider to be weeds.
Yeah, and we have some of that going on right here in Wisconsin, as a matter of fact. What if you think about the behavior of beetles there, what for you would be among the most interesting behaviors of beetles?
Well, one of the most interesting behaviors I can think of right now, just looking outside every evening right now, are fireflies or lightning bugs. Having grown up on the fringes of the Mojave Desert in Southern California, I didn't grow up with these insects, and having them now in my front garden is just fantastic. I feel like a kid in a candy store, and knowing that the bioluminescence, in the adults anyway, serves primarily the purpose of mate recognition, finding a mate, but also it serves as a warning in all stages of their development to potential predators that they taste bad. So it sort of has a dual purpose there.
You mentioned the sex. You talked a little bit about the reproductive, but the sex life of beetles I found kind of interesting because they don't have a whole lot of time to look for partners.
No, they don't. They don't have time to waste. And, you know, there's an interesting story with fireflies. Is there's one species of firefly that the females need a certain chemical, and the only way they can get it is by consuming a male of another species. And they turn on a very different signal and lure in a male, not as a mate, but as a meal. And once they're sated, they reset their signal, this time to lure in a male as a mate, and then carry on about their business. They're the femme fatales of the beetle world.
Bob in Iola has something to offer here. Bob, hi, thank you for calling.
Hey, good show. Hey, listen, since you're a Western guy, maybe you can comment on the Western bark beetles. How is that going to wind up? I see whole mountain ranges just chewed up to pieces. And as an environmentalist ecologist, it makes you want to cry, even though it's part of the ecology.
Well, it is. It's a very sad story, and it's a concurrent result of many events happening, primarily the drought that's been going on for decades in the West, and the trees are unable to produce pitch or sap that they would normally use to engulf eggs and defend themselves. And the beetles take advantage of these trees that are stressed, and when they find a tree that's in trouble, they will zero in on it and produce chemicals that attract even more beetles and just swamp the tree's already taxed ability to defend itself. And here in the East, we don't really have appreciation for that, but as you said, millions and millions of trees have been lost, covering millions of acres in the West, and there doesn't seem to be any let-up in this. This is something that's going to be going on for some time. It's very sad.
Yeah, very sad.
Do you have any feeling on how it's finally going to shake out? We're just going to lose all the conifers in the West? Or?
Well, you know, these habitats are evolving all the time. There are going to be other species, you know, in areas where we see forests that are disappearing. We may see the appearance of shrubs that weren't very prominent but now have a chance to gain a foothold or a root hold, I guess you would say, in these habitats. So as they disappear, there are always going to be other species available to take their place. But a combination of drought and repeated fires in some areas, it's going to make it very difficult for these habitats to recover. They will, but it's unlikely they'll resemble something that we would recognize, at least certainly not in our lifetime.
Yeah.
Thanks much for all your work.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Bob. Thanks a lot for calling. Visiting today with Arthur Evans, entomologist, author, lecturer, photographer, and broadcaster. He's written a number of books, including the one we're talking about today, titled Beetles of Eastern North America. It's published by Princeton Press. Great book, and fun talking with him today. I'm Larry Mueller. Jason Butler, our on-air producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hope you'll stay tuned, because coming up at 11:45, we're going to be learning about the incredible diversity of Wisconsin's streams and the wildlife and fauna that inhabit those streams. Right now, though, we're talking with Art Evans about his book, Beetles of Eastern North America. You may have a question or comment. What intrigues you about beetles? Are you a beetles fan? Have you observed beetle behavior that you found kind of perplexing? Heck, we can talk about that. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. Maybe you have a photo that you'd like to share, a beetle photo. Post that on my Facebook page along with a question at the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. And, of course, you can always email your questions. The email address is talk@WPR.org. It's talk@WPR.org. Great to talk today with our guest, Art Evans. Art, let's talk about the anatomy of beetles. What makes them so... Obviously, they're very successful.
Well, they are very successful. Well, first and foremost, they're insects. You know, they have an external skeleton. They have three body regions, a head, thorax, and abdomen. They belong to a subset of insects that develop by complete metamorphosis, as I mentioned, which have an egg, larva, pupa, and adult. And they also have chewing mouth parts, which puts them into an even smaller group of insects. But the primary feature that distinguishes them from all other insects is the fact that they have these soft, leathery, or hardened shell-like forewings called elytra. And it's those elytra that pre-adapt them, if you will, to living in all kinds of environments. In the little cavity below those elytra, they can capture an air bubble and breathe underwater, or they can live in extremely hot deserts and help insulate themselves from the warm temperatures outside their body and so on. And it protects their delicate wings and internal organs from damage as they're chewing, burrowing, digging, mining through plants and soils.
If you want to observe them, you want to get out and observe them, what are some good tips or pointers?
Well, you know, there's a lot of these great binoculars that are out there now that are close focusing. You know, you can actually stand there and see your toes in focus and walk out with a pair of binoculars like that and start looking for beetles on flowers. That's always a great place to start. If you you might notice dung, pardon me, you might notice dung beetles. You could be on the edge of a pond or a slow-moving stream and see beetles actually swimming around in the water. There are all kinds of places to look for beetles. Or at lights at night, that's always a great one, too. Many beetles are nocturnal and attracted to lights.
And what about collecting? Is it okay to collect beetles?
It depends on where you are. I'm a great proponent of collecting beetles. I believe that insect collecting is the best way to learn about insects, especially beetles. Many beetles can't be identified with certainty unless you have the specimen in hand. That's just a fact. And so it's a great way to learn about insects, but you've got to be careful. If you're in a national park or a state park or some sort of public land, Native American lands, you need permission from the land management authority, usually in writing, to do insect collecting, but if you're on private lands, it's always a good idea to have permission from the landowner. And many people welcome insect collectors to come on their property, and many of us that are entomologists today started with collecting insects that we found just locally around our homes.
Judy in Madison has a comment. Hi, Judy. Thank you for calling.
Hi, speaking about locally and insects, I was having lunch on the deck, which is in the front of our house near an extensive garden, and the deck is maybe 8 inches off the ground. It's like a step and a half up, so mm-hmm. it's really close to the ground, and there was a staghorn beetle there
nice.
Looking at me. It was about an inch and a half or 2 inches, and when I stood up I was done eating. I stood up to go into the house. The dude reared back on his hind parts and was menacing me.
I love those beetles. To me, beetles like that are like seeing old friends. You know, they come around once a year, and you get to enjoy them again and again. I love that. That's great.
Is that a protection sort of mechanism for that particular beetle?
Well, the stag beetles, especially the males of some species, have very enlarged, elaborate mandibles. But the mandibles are used primarily in battles with other males over nearby females. And so that's what that's all about. But it's the females usually that can give you the more painful nip if you pick one up. They have a pretty powerful mandible. Don't let the size fool you.
No. Judy, thanks. Appreciate the call very much. So they protect. How do they protect themselves? And so they fight with those. The males fight that way.
Well, usually these are bloodless battles. The males use their mandibles, or in the case of horn beetles, they use their mandibles or their horns like forceps, and they sort of lift the rival male off its feet and roll it over, and the vanquished male usually will just walk away. They usually don't injure one another. But the fact that most beetles have very hard exoskeletons, sharp claws, and some of them certainly can bite, that protects them. And others are filled with noxious or caustic chemicals that make them undesirable to potential predators.
Mm. Hank in Galena, Illinois. Hi, thank you for calling. Hank, are you there?
Hello, yes.
Hi.
I was curious to know... is the Grant's Park rhinoceros beetle prevalent at all in the eastern United States? Because it seemed to be all over the place in the west.
No, the eastern and western Hercules beetles are both in the genus Dynastes, which is primarily a tropical genus. But the western one, which you call Grant's horn beetle, that's found in Utah, southern Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico, and into Mexico. It does not occur in the east. The one that's in eastern U.S., in fact, there's a picture of it on Larry's Facebook page of me holding one. That's the eastern Hercules beetle, Dynastes tidius, and they just get into southern Illinois, as I recall.
Yeah, that's a cool picture. Yeah, that's a cool picture, by the way. You look like you're having a good time looking at that guy.
Oh, anytime I can spend with beetles is always a good time.
You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to hear from you. How often do they reproduce?
Well, again, it depends on the beetle. There are some that produce a new generation only once a year, and others can produce several generations throughout the year. Certainly in warmer parts of the country, think the Gulf Coast states where it's relatively mild even during the winter time, beetles theoretically can be reproducing continually. But some species take several years in order to develop and mature into an adult.
Boy. And what are their biggest threats as far as predators go?
Well, probably as predators go, there are mammals that feed on the larvae and certainly the adults, and there are birds that certainly go after them. Spiders certainly capture their share and their webs, and there are a number of other fish, reptiles, amphibians that certainly go after them. But by and large, the single largest threat to beetles and any species, for that matter, is habitat degradation and destruction. That's what most of them are suffering from.
Yeah, I would imagine. So sort of humans are maybe the biggest threat. Inadvertently.
I mean, you know, it's the things that we do that we don't really think about the impact they have on other organisms. But, you know, certainly... deforestation, converting habitat into agricultural lands, just mowing, just driving can take out lots of insects. And, of course, beetles are a significant portion of those insects.
Barbara in Green Bay up next. Barbara, hi. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. What an interesting show. I've lived in Green Bay, Wisconsin since I was 7, and I remember enjoying lightning bugs in the summertime all the time. We caught them in jars, and we just loved. We were outside a lot more when I was a child. But I don't recall seeing lightning bugs for a very long time, and I'm wondering, are they still around in the Green Bay area or in Wisconsin at all?
Oh, yes.
Well, lightning bugs are certainly there. I can't speak to Wisconsin in particular. I'm here in Richmond, Virginia today, but this has been a banner year for lightning bugs here, just spectacular. But there has been concern across the country, across the eastern United States, about the lack of lightning bugs and fireflies. And part of the problem is that a lot of new people are moving to newly established neighborhoods where there's a lack of habitat for their larvae. The larvae are predators. They feed on earthworms and slugs, things like that. And in these very well manicured, very tidy gardens, there's no place for them to call home. But in well established neighborhoods where there's a little bit of duff on the ground or in undisturbed woodlands and in parks where there's a bit of woods around, they're seem to be doing very well.
Yeah. Well, I'm very glad. I'm just disappointed that I haven't seen them.
Well, keep watching. I actually just saw my first firefly of the year last week.
Oh, okay. Well, so they're slowly moving northward. We've had them here out for about a month now. In fact, they're starting to wind down a little bit, but I'm like a kid in a candy store. I get very excited about seeing the first one for the year, and I always call out the first one I see every night.
I'll keep my eyes open, and thank you for a wonderful show.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org. Or post a photo on my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show, and we'll get an identification for you. Wendy from Trempolo says, where can I send a picture of a beetle for identification? Well, if you can post it online, that would be a really quick way to do it.
Well, and I also see that James Edwards has just posted a photo of the Eastern Hercules beetle. And it's the very same beetle that I'm holding in the picture on your Facebook page.
Oh, yeah.
I said, it's like seeing an old friend. These are great.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. That's a beautiful beetle, isn't it?
Well, that's very much the male. The females look very similar but lack the horns, and they regulate their moisture through their elytra, so a well-hydrated, well-fed beetle will turn almost completely black, and then when they start moving about again, they'll turn back to this usual olive color with irregular spots on their wings. They're very, very handsome insect. I love them.
Yeah, they are beautiful. The segments are so cool. The body segments.
Yes, I think that's one of the things that's appealed to me about beetles from the very beginning. People often ask, you know, what is it about beetles over everything else? And I'm afraid I don't always have a very pat answer for that. But I think the fact that they're everywhere and they're incredibly diverse in terms of their form and their habit has always fascinated me ever since I was a young boy.
Yeah. Jeanette in Fall Creek has something to add. Jeanette, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, yes, great program. I work with Beaver Creek Reserve Citizen Science Center up here in Fall Creek, and I'm hearing lots of questions about fireflies in Wisconsin. And I just wanted to let listeners know that there is a citizen science project that Beaver Creek helped bring to Wisconsin 2 years ago, and it's called Firefly Watch. And it's where citizens can just sit in their backyard and monitor fireflies. And the program is with the Museum of Science in Boston. And if people are interested, if you just Google Firefly Watch, it'll take you to the Boston's Museum of Science page. And people can, you know, take a part in not just learning about fireflies, but doing a little citizen science on the side.
Thank you so much for bringing that up. That's a wonderful citizen science project, and they're very active. And it started as a concern that many people had that fireflies were disappearing, and now we're able to get some solid data together from observations. And you don't have to be a scientist to make a valuable contribution to this project. So thank you so much for calling our attention to that.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, appreciate it very much. And let's turn to Jack in Mercer next. Hi, Jack. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I have a question on the praying mantis. I've watched and studied them quite a bit, and I wonder if they're in the beetle family, as, you know, they have a shell on them, more or less, an exoskeleton. And upon observing real close-up pictures, it seems that they almost have pupils on their eyes. And they're not exactly in the center, they're offset, but I wonder if that is what those are.
Well, those are both great questions. First of all, praying mantises are actually in their own another group of insects. Beetles are in the order Coleoptera, and praying mantises are in the order Mantodea. They're more closely related to cockroaches and termites, and they have heavy four wings, but they're a different type of modification that we call Tegmina. They're not the Coleoptera, and they also have a very different development, too. They have a gradual metamorphosis. They start out as nymphs. They don't have a larval or pupal stage in their development, and the pupil that you notice in their compound eyes, that's actually an artifact of the physical structure of their compound eyes. Each eye is made up of multiple facets or lenses that sits atop of a cone-shaped structure, and depending on your angle of view, the light only passes down these structures so far, and from a certain angle, the light penetration is very shallow, and so that's what creates the impression of a pupil. And if you move around and look at it from different points of view, it'll shift around.
Hmm. Yeah, that's what I said. Very interesting.
Thank you.
I have some great pictures. I'll have to send in some of my pictures. They're just fabulous. I took them with a little micro lens, and so they're larger than life size, and, you know, to look them over really close, it's really quite amazing.
Great.
Thanks. Yeah, post them up on my Facebook page, Jack.
I will.
All right. I appreciate that very much. Jack from Mercer will be posting some praying mantis photos on the Facebook page. That's wonderful. You can post photos, too. Just go to my website at my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show, and you can do the exact same thing. I'm wondering about those eyes. Do we know, or have we kind of figured out what a beetle might actually see through those eyes?
Well, what they're seeing, you know, the Hollywood version of what an insect sees is multiple images of the same scene. You know, as we were kids, you could pick up one of those toys, the dragonfly eye, and you look out and, you know, you look at a friend's face and you see 30 faces. And that's not what insects see. What they see is sort of a highly pixelated version of one scene. And some insects have very acute vision, and they can see reasonably well, not nearly as well as we can, but they can see well enough, as anybody can attest to who's tried to swat a fly or capture a dragonfly. They may not be able to see as well as we do, but they do very well.
And they can smell. Some of them, can't they?
Some of them can smell and taste right. They don't have a nose like you and I do, but depending on the species, they'll have taste receptors on their feet, certainly associated with their mouth. Some insects smell or taste with their antennae. It just depends on the species we're looking at.
Yeah, because actually some will attract, females will attract males with pheromones.
Right. In fact, this is something we see in beetles a lot, where the female releases what we call a pheromone that's a sexual attractant, and it will attract males sometimes from a great distance. Males are often easily distinguished from the females because they have very elaborate antennae, and those elaborate antennae allow more surface areas to be packed with these very sensitive sensory pits that can pick up just a few molecules of the female's scent.
Let's turn to Tanya next in Madison. Hi, Tanya. Thank you for calling.
Hi. So I have a question. My husband and I mentioned the other day that he had read somewhere that you could buy praying mantises in larva form and put a large quantity in your garden to help keep all of the different bugs and beetles and insects that attacked all of the vegetables and fruits at bay. And I was wondering whether or not this was actually a good idea to introduce a large population of an insect like a praying mantis to, a cityscape like Madison.
Well, chances are the praying mantis is usually it's the Chinese mantis is the egg case that's usually available a little bit earlier in the year, and they're available through many different sources. Chances are they're already established, although where you are they may not do as well overwintering, and so they may certainly persist through the winter in some cases, but they're already there. And so these species that are being sold are things that are already found in these areas. So even though they're from somewhere else originally, Chinese mantis was introduced to both the East and West Coast in the late 1800s, and now they're widespread throughout the U.S. So you're not introducing something new, but chances are you've got all kinds of naturally occurring predators and parasitoids that are already in your garden doing exactly what you want to do. But if you expect to go out and find no pests whatsoever, you're going to be disappointed. there's always somebody lurking around out there nibbling on something.
Absolutely. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. So how did you get so interested in beetles, Art?
Oh, I was just one of those kids that grew up putting things in jars. Like I say, I grew up on the fringes of the Mojave Desert and spent a lot of time outdoors. And I had some very good mentors growing up, science teachers, librarians, and some very encouraging parents and very understanding friends that didn't make too much fun of me when I was interested in this. And I've been very fortunate to maintain and build on this lifelong interest.
Yeah, it's really great. And your book, the book itself, I really enjoyed the front part of the book, too, where you're sort of explaining life cycle and identifying characteristics. And you have some great photographs within the book of just capturing bugs and things like that. And then, obviously, you get to the photo section. It's unbelievable photos.
Well, thank you. I worked with over 90 photographers to put that together. I had three principal photographers that contributed about 700 photographs to the work, and then the other 800 photographs were through those other 87 photographers. It was very much a collective effort, but I wanted to make beetles accessible. I think a lot of people are intimidated by them because there are so many, and also their size. They're often difficult to see, but now there are so many great cameras out there. People are going out and taking pictures and seeing insects like never before. This is a great opportunity to give beetles their due.
Yeah, and it's, boy, if you're interested in insects, this is definitely a book to get hold of. It's wonderful. And Art, I want to thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. I really appreciate it. I learned a lot.
Well, it's my pleasure to be here, and thank you so much for your interest.
Oh, appreciate it very much. Arthur Evans, our guest today, he is the author of several books, and the latest is the one we were talking about, Beetles of Eastern North America. And you've got to see some of these beetles, I mean, to really believe it. They are just some fascinating-looking creatures, and it was a lot of fun talking about them. Coming up next, we're going to continue to talk about wildlife and how to enjoy wildlife, and we'll be talking with a couple of the authors of a field guide, a new field guide. It's called The Field Guide to Wisconsin Streams, Plants, Fishes, Invertebrates, Amphibians, and Reptiles. Man, lots to talk about there. I hope you'll stay with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.